From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, the state and Michigan's counties try to get on the same page tracking who's getting vaccinated by race.
We can now go back and take all of the information we've had for all of this time and add it in. And actually, the state contact tracers, now that cases are down, are going to be able to help with that.
Also today, naming the violence and the fear Asian Americans are living with during the pandemic.
These acts of hate were reported in the news as early as January and February. Some were acts of verbal harassment, and some were horrific acts of violence.
And a snapshot of college life during the pandemic.
We do wear masks around our house when we're not in our rooms to make sure that, you know, we're all being as safe as we can. So it's definitely a change from last year.
Those stories and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. COVID-19 rates among Michigan's college students are in decline, but in one community, they still constitute about half of all county cases. Today on the program, we're going to talk with some students about what college life has been like during the pandemic.
We do wear masks around our house when we're not in our rooms to make sure that, you know, we're all being as safe as we can. So it's definitely a change from last year.
That's coming up later in the hour. But first, some new data that tells a lot about who's getting vaccine access in Michigan. The good news is we finally have vaccination data from the state about race. The bad news is nearly half of it is missing. And the other bad news is, based on the data we do have, Black Michiganders appear to be getting vaccinated at much, much lower rates than white residents. Here to break this down for us is Michigan Radio's Kate Wells. Hi, Kate.
Hey, April.
So, Kate, the state health department made this announcement yesterday that it's going to add race to the vaccine dashboard, which tracks who's getting vaccine shots and where they're getting them. Can you give us the takeaway?
Here's the big picture breakdown for the 1.2 million people in Michigan who have so far gotten at least one dose of the vaccine. Nearly 47% of them are listed as unknown. 42% are white. Almost 10% are listed as other, almost 4% are Black, and coming in at 1% or less are Asian or Pacific Islanders, American Indians, and Alaskan Natives. So it's not great.
So I want to get back to the disparities, but why is it there are so many unknowns in this data?
Yeah, the short answer here is that the state did not build a very good system for tracking race. So we are missing, as you can see here, about 500,000 people in terms of their race information. The system that they'd initially rolled out to hospitals and health systems, it can pick up race from electronic health records that, you know, hospitals use, like your doctor would have on you. And so most of the information we do have is coming from those records. But if you went and got vaccinated at one of those big mass clinics where, like, you sometimes even, like, drive your car in and then drive out, they didn't have a way there to literally enter your race information by hand into that statewide system. The state says that they have fixed that. You now can enter it by hand, which is pretty important. And they're asking providers to actually go back through all of their records now that you can do that and re-enter that information. One of the people I talked to about this is Linda Vale. She's the Ingham County Health Officer, and they've been doing these mass clinics. And she says, yeah, they have been tracking race just in their own records.
We can now go back and take all of the information we've had for all of this time and add it in. And actually, the state contact tracers, now that cases are down, are going to be able to help with that.
So, Kate, maybe basically we might get a better picture if more places go back and do the work and fill in that information?
Yeah, although, again, we don't know how many places are like Ingham County and tracked this, even though they couldn't enter it into the system. Really, like, the best that we can hope for here is that, yeah, we get a little bit of that past data, but that we really focus on going forward, being able to enter this data as we do more vaccinations.
And like you said, what we do see, wow, it's just really grim. Just 3% of all folks vaccinated at this point in Michigan have identified as Black. Again, a lot of missing data, but that's not good.
Yeah, especially, you know, you compare that 3% identified as Black with 14% of the state's population being Black. And Michigan is not alone in this. We are seeing major disparities like this all over the nation from the CDC's numbers and also in individual other states that have also released their data. And this is a major concern, obviously, but Black people have been disproportionately more likely to get sick from COVID. They're more likely to die from it. I know we've heard all these discussions before, but the state put these numbers out yesterday that I just think are worth reading. The COVID case rate has been 40% higher for Black Michiganders than white residents. Two, the death rate for Black residents has been over 3 times the rate in white residents. And finally, right now, whites are about twice as likely to be vaccinated as Blacks in Michigan.
So why is it that the vaccine disparities are so huge, given that we knew that Black Michiganders were adversely affected by the spread of the virus?
Yeah, there are a lot of reasons. And the state is really trying to sort of address some of these moving forward here. Some of the reasons and barriers are structural, right? Like your access to transportation or your ability to get good up-to-date information about where to get vaccinated, who's eligible, whether you have a doctor in a major health system who can help you enroll when they're doing vaccinations, whether the clinics are happening in your neighborhood. You know, we've seen the Detroit mayor, Mike Duggan, say, you know, a lot of our residents are not linked into a major hospital system like Michigan Medicine or Beaumont, where they've been doing vaccinations. And he's making the case that essentially the state should be sending more at the city level rather than through these health systems.
What about vaccine hesitancy, Kate? Do you think that's playing a role? And if so, how much?
Yeah, I mean, that's also hard to really put numbers on and know, because it's going to vary so much from individual to individual. And I want to be really careful that when we talk about vaccine hesitancy, we don't use that somehow as like an excuse for why these disparities are there. Because when you look at what numbers we do have here, the state did a survey back in November. So keep that in mind that it's dated. But there were major differences in vaccine adoption by race. 47% of white Michiganders said they were very likely to get the vaccine versus 25% of Black respondents. And a lot of the themes that came up were concerns about side effects, not wanting to feel like a test subject, needing to know more about the safety, needing to see how it performs over time, and concern about whether this vaccine was pushed out before it was safe.
So the state knows that this problem exists. Are there other things being done to try to correct it?
Yeah, we are seeing the state really emphasize the social vulnerability index, which comes from the CDC, and it basically weighs a place based on census data about everything from poverty to race to crowded housing units, and it ranks those communities by risks. And the state is saying, we're going to try and weight our vaccine distribution so that we put more in those really at-risk communities. That is starting to get some pushback from places like Livingston County. And even today, you know, you heard the lieutenant governor, Garland Gilchrist. He spoke about this very publicly. He said, you know, we need more of this data. And we have these plans to distribute the vaccine equitably. And he also did something that you see experts recommend as a way to help with vaccine hesitancy, which is that people want to see that other people like them are getting it and they're safe.
Hey everybody, it's Lieutenant Governor Garland Gilchrist, and I'm here with my Grandma Maddie. We are in Southfield at the Pavilion, and Grandma just got her first dose of the Pfizer vaccine. I want to thank her and thank everyone who's here in Southfield getting their vaccines today. And I want to make sure that everyone knows that the vaccine is safe and effective, and when it's your turn, please get vaccinated.
That's Lieutenant Governor Garland Gilchrist, of course, Michigan's highest-ranking Black elected official. What other efforts are underway, Kate?
Yeah, there are a bunch of specific outreach efforts underway. Vaccination clinics at Black churches, for instance, starting to route vaccinations to health centers that are submitting plans for how they're going to get vulnerable community members vaccinated. But of course, with the supply still being so limited and with so many people wanting a vaccine who can't get one yet, local health departments say that they have to really strike a balance between efficiency and equity. Linda Vale, again, the Ingham County health officer who you heard earlier, she says that's a tough balance to strike.
We always want to get vaccine out as soon as possible from when we get it in. But when you're talking, and we're up to a little over 3,000 doses, new doses this week, when you're talking about doing that and having to go around in a, you know, a senior housing complex where you might do 60 and then move here, that's a very slow and inefficient process to get out 3,000 doses in a week.
So this is, again, an issue of vaccine supply, too, as well.
Michigan Radio's Kate Wells. Kate, thank you so much. We'll look forward to getting some more updates as you learn more.
Thank you, April.
We've had some pretty interesting conversations about COVID lately on the Stateside podcast. Did you catch our COVID question and answer session last Thursday? We were talking to the chief COVID strategist for Wayne County and a great reporter from the Detroit Free Press. They were just fielding listeners' questions one after the other. Stuff like that, which you might have missed, you can just download and listen to it when you're getting dinner ready or maybe folding the laundry or going out for a walk tonight. Subscribe to the Stateside podcast with whatever app you like best for listening. Earlier this week, we talked about the public outcry in Ann Arbor from parents and city council after the school board punted on whether to return to the classroom or continue virtually this school year. Whether the wave of upset parents turned the tide or the board simply wanted more answers about plans to reopen, Superintendent Janice Swift proposed today that Ann Arbor Public Schools begin a phased-in approach starting March 25th.
We understand the significant need to have our students and staff, our students and families, have that option of return to in-school learning.
The board approved the plan, making Ann Arbor the final major district to confirm its plans through summer. Board member Jeff Gaynor says that the hybrid plan with physical distancing, face masks, and desk shields is less than ideal.
As a former classroom teacher from grades 1 through 8, I will say it's not the classroom I am used to that I want to have that is the best possible for teaching, but it is necessary.
Ann Arbor's plan is also contingent on all of the district's teachers and staff having access to vaccination against COVID ahead of returning to the classroom. The district announced earlier this week it's made a partnership with the University of Michigan to make that happen. Coming up, a fascinating and disturbing link between political messages disparaging China and hate crimes against Asian Americans.
This is not just a one-off event. It's widespread, it's common, it's happening a lot. Asian Americans are fearful, and political leaders need to be held accountable.
That's in a moment. We'll be right back. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Fear has been such a big part of pandemic life for the past year or so, but some of us are experiencing it in a very specific way. Racist attacks on Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders have increased over the past year. Melissa May Borja is an assistant professor in the Department of American Culture at the University of Michigan, and she's been keeping tabs on this form of violence. Melissa, welcome to Stateside.
I'm so grateful to be here.
You've been active with a group that originally started out of California called Stop AAPI Hate, AAPI being Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders. And this group started up as a sort of reporting center on March 19th, 2020. What can you tell us about the type of incidents that you and other folks in the group were hearing about and what you wanted to keep tabs on?
Right. So there has been a very alarming rise in acts of hate against Asian American and Pacific Islander people in the United States associated with the pandemic. And these acts of hate were reported in the news as early as January and February. Some were acts of verbal harassment, and some were horrific acts of violence. So Stop AAPI Hate began as a collaboration of academics and activists associated with community organizations to understand these trends, both to inform public policy and also guide the activism of community organizations. And we found that the pandemic really did see a rise in attacks against Asian Americans. I think one thing that's very challenging about doing any sort of work about Asian Americans is spread out across the country. Asian Americans aren't necessarily a very large population. They live often in states like California or New York, but if you live in a place like Indiana or Michigan, Asian American issues are often overlooked because compared to the rest of the population, it's a pretty small community. But what Stop AAPI Hate really usefully did is collect all of the information happening all across the country in order to say this is a problem that is not just a one-off event. It's widespread, it's common, it's happening a lot. Asian Americans are fearful and political leaders need to be held accountable.
Right. You've written about the partisan rhetoric that blames Asian people and Asian American people for the pandemic. This was a specific tracking of social media posts, among other things. This is a relevant issue for Michiganders because there have been some elected officials in Michigan who've used phrases like the Wuhan virus or the China virus. Can you make the link for us between a tweet like that or something that, you know, that blames wet markets for the pandemic and the personal safety and mental health of folks in the community?
Yeah, I think for a lot of people who aren't aware of this problem, it seems harmless to use a term like Wuhan coronavirus, but it actually really matters. Well before the COVID-19 pandemic began, major health organizations like the WHO had guidelines to recommend people naming diseases in a way that doesn't stigmatize a group of people or a place, that doesn't associate a disease with a particular community. What we saw in March, though, was politicians using terms like China virus and Chinese virus with increased frequency. And it's hard to draw a causal relationship, but it certainly does coincide. When politicians use language like Wuhan flu or Kung flu, it coincided with a rise in anti-Asian hostility, anti-Asian discrimination, anti-Asian violence. It got to the point where even the FBI was warning of increased hate crimes against Asian Americans because of the association between Asian Americans and the coronavirus. I think one of the most striking incidents that took place in March, which was the month when many politicians, the most prominent of which was Donald Trump, used terms explicitly like China virus, despite the fact that people were asking him not to do so. We saw during that month a really horrific incident in Texas where a Burmese family was shopping on a Saturday, two young children under the age of 6, the father and the 2 sons were stabbed in the face. And what's notable about that incident is it precipitated the FBI to release a statement warning of rising violence against Asian Americans. But that incident also involved the person who stabbed the family explicitly blaming them for the coronavirus. So I did that study with my team really to see the partisan patterns and other patterns of who is using those terms. And we were pretty surprised to see both how insistent some politicians were in using those terms, how casual they were in using those terms. And we continue to emphasize that it's dangerous to do any of those things. You could call the coronavirus. You could use a term like COVID-19. You don't need to use a term like Wuhan flu. That was hurtful to my community.
We live in a culture that poses a lot of different kinds of direct threats to many different people of color. There are a lot of Americans who spend a lot of time thinking about this stuff because of Black Lives Matter. And I feel like we're in this place where some people might think about police violence against Black Americans and Latino Americans and start to see things in terms of a hierarchy of threats. If a person is Asian American, they might think, well, you know, I see what's happening in the streets of this country every day. Maybe what's happening to me is not really, it's not really worth talking about. This idea of a hierarchy of harm that happens because of racism, do you see that affecting our response to what AAPI folks are experiencing right now?
This is a complicated question, and I think Asian Americans have always found themselves in a complex racial position in the United States, where historically the conversation about race has been very much along a black-white binary. The question of where Asian Americans fit into that is challenging and complicated. I think it's pretty clear if you look at U.S. history, Asian Americans have very frequently been subjected to violence. And I think this is a key point that's often overlooked, that the anti-Asian racism and violence that we are seeing in the current moment is not new, that there are many instances of racism and violence against Asian American that go back to the 19th century. I think one aspect of this conversation about a hierarchy of harm is that it reflects that we don't actually know a lot about Asian Americans and their place in American history. And I think that if we thought about contemporary violence and racism against Asian Americans in light of histories of exclusion, in light of histories of incarceration of Japanese Americans, of the colonization and the war against Filipinos, I think we might have a different view of where Asian Americans fit into the conversation about racism in the U.S. I would also say one thing that has been notable about responses to violence in the past month has been the very explicit call for solidarity among Black and Asian American activists. So in the wake of the killing the Thai American man last month, we saw last week Black and Asian Americans in the Bay Area hold a march of solidarity together. And I think that that is really where we're going to see things go moving forward.
Some of the high profile events that Stop AAPI Hate has been tracking happened in Texas, like you say, or the Bay Area or California. But you've also documented instances of harassment in Michigan. What can you tell us?
Yeah, I think this is a really important point because we often tend to think that issues facing Asian Americans are California issues or New York issues, which is to say that these incidents don't happen here in Michigan or in the Midwest, where people are friendly and where there aren't that many Asian American people to begin with. But what I think is a really important point is that this is a national problem. So I'll just give a few examples. In March in Detroit, March 2020 in Detroit, a man was working at a Polish meat market and a customer told him that he didn't want Chinese hands on his meat. He was yelled to go back to China and take the virus with him. We saw in the same month a virtual meeting of the Board of Trustees where people interrupted the meeting and made racially and sexually charged comments against Chinese people and Asian people. We saw in Shelby Township in April a trail sign in a park that had graffiti on it that blamed Asian people for COVID. So these are surprisingly common events. Stop AAPI Hate has been tracking these incidents through two means. My team looks at hate incidents that are reported in news media, and another team looks at hate incidents that are self-reported from Asian Americans themselves. And they're coming from all across the country in various forms. And I should emphasize, it's striking that these events are occurring even as we have largely been staying at home during the pandemic. So I do wonder if things would have been worse if we were out and about more often. But we are staying home and they're still happening. People are still having these hate incidents happen when they're just going about their daily business. And that's alarming.
Melissa, do you think that Asian American Pacific Islander folks who are in this community, do you think they tend to self-edit when they're talking about these incidents, whereas maybe they don't even see them or talk about them as something deserving of some larger attention?
I think that there is a lot of self-editing. I don't know if this is unique to Asian Americans, to be honest. I think that a lot of people who experience harmful and hurtful incidents don't report them, sort of as a general rule. But I do think that there are some cultural barriers that exist. So there is some evidence that suggests that Asian Americans who are from another country and are immigrants in the United States might not necessarily realize that a hate crime or a hate incident is a thing, that they could seek help from a community organization or law enforcement about. A student of mine recently did an informal survey of Asian American business owners in Sterling Heights and found that a surprisingly large percentage of them didn't really have a plan for what they would do if their businesses were involved in some sort of bias incident. And so I think a lot of the underreporting has to do with the lack of awareness that this is something that they could report and they should report, and a lack of awareness about how to handle them if they do experience something like it. I also do have to acknowledge, I think, something that is related to what you brought up, which is about this idea of self-editing. I think it's a real thing that Asian American people might not be familiar with talking about racism or as comfortable talking about racism. You know, I was born and raised in Michigan. My parents lived in Michigan in the early 1980s, and I recently asked them what it was like living during the time of the killing of Vincent Chin. And they said it was safer, in their view, at that time, just to keep quiet. And I don't think that's an uncommon view among a lot of Asian Americans who are relatively new to the United States, that it might be safer just to keep quiet. So I think there is a lot of education that's necessary to do.
Why is it important? This feels like kind of a strange question, but why is it important for us to talk in an unvarnished way about the fear that people feel or the anger they feel when they hear about this stuff happening?
By the unvarnished fear that Asian Americans feel?
Yeah.
Is that? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it feels truthful. I think it's important for us to be honest and truthful about how people are afraid. I can't tell you how many times over the past year I have heard friends and neighbors speak about their fear of just going to the grocery store. And I will speak honestly here when I say that I did not go to the grocery store myself until June. I sent someone else to get groceries for me, not simply because I was afraid of getting the coronavirus, but because I had known so many people who are spit on, targeted in verbal attacks just for doing daily activities. And to not talk about that, to not talk about that contemporary racism and harm, and to not talk about the history that informs that racism and harm, feels untruthful and dishonest. And, you know, I'm not always quite sure what to make of people saying, well, that they didn't know about anti-Asian racism until this moment. Part of me wonders, well, did you learn about Japanese incarceration in school? Did you learn about the killing of Vincent Chin in school? It indicates to me, if this is a new topic, then we really need to rethink how we are educating our American public.
I was thinking about what you said about having conversations with, you know, mothers and fathers and grandfathers who've maybe been in this country for a long time, maybe were born here and have been dealing with it their whole lives, and how, you know, they can sometimes, you know, feel like it's better not to say anything. I think that really says something about how long this has been going on in this country and how deeply it's felt.
I think that's right. I think also that the research indicates that the longer people are in the United States, and by people I'm here speaking about Asian immigrants, and Asian Americans, the longer that Asian Americans are in the United States, the more likely they are to support policies like affirmative action and progressive policies regarding race. I think that it is kind of a daunting thing to step into if you're relatively new in the United States, but the longer you are here in the United States, I think a lot of Asian Americans realize, oh, racism is a real problem and it affects me. You know, I think for a lot of Asian Americans, it might feel comforting to, to buy into the fiction that racism doesn't affect them. But I think it becomes clear to people pretty quickly that racism is a real problem and that it does affect Asian Americans, and that it does nobody any good to stay quiet about it, that it really is in service to oneself and one's children and one's next generation to be honest and truthful and courageous about speaking out about it.
Are you going to the grocery store these days?
Very rarely. I send my white husband to do it.
Melissa May Borja is an assistant professor in the Department of American Culture at the University of Michigan. Melissa, thank you for talking to us.
Thank you very much.
In just a moment, we'll catch up on what's happening in one of the last public school districts to return to face-to-face learning. That's after the break. We'll be right back. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. In his weekly COVID-19 update, University of Michigan President Mark Schlissel made a statement that caught our attention. He said university-related COVID cases currently comprise 62% of total cases in Washtenaw County. That's up from one-third of total cases on February 3rd. And the reason, according to Schlissel, is large social gatherings. What is a student to do? Here to talk to us about what actual college life looks like 1 year into the pandemic are a pair of roommates in Ann Arbor. Amanda Vogel, she's a first-year graduate student at the College of Pharmacy. Hi, Amanda.
Hello.
And Theo Zangolis, he is a senior studying political science. Theo, hello.
Hi, April.
How are you guys doing?
All right, just staying warm out here.
Let's talk a little bit about your classes. Are they in person or virtual?
Mine are all virtual right now, and we're coming back a little bit in person starting in March.
Theo, how about you?
Mine are all online.
All online. Yeah, so, I mean, are there even times when either of you set foot on campus these days?
Primarily for COVID testing, actually.
Yeah, I hardly ever go to campus unless it's just walking through usually.
Interesting. I do see the odd person walking around with a backpack kind of looking like an undergrad or a grad student, and I assume they've probably got something to do with either labs or medical instruction. We know that there are still some people there because of that. I hear that you two hang your hats at a fraternity house with 16 other students. What's that been like? Could you just describe like who lives there and what the living conditions are like?
Yeah, so we're an undergraduate fraternity. Like you said, I think there's about 16 of us living here. And we all, for the most part, most of us are living in single rooms, don't have roommates. There are, you know, some of us with roommates. But we are, you know, trying to be very cognizant of COVID, you know, wearing masks in the house, trying to take every precaution that we can to prevent, you know, the spread of COVID within the house. It has been honestly pretty interesting to live with a group of people in these sort of strange COVID times. It's, you know, been nice to have a group of people to live with and sort of ride this out together, I guess.
Amanda?
Yeah, I would, you know, agree with that sentiment. For the most part, we've been pretty lucky. We haven't really had any cases in the house this far, which has been really nice, but you know, there are some pros and cons. It's definitely nice to, you know, feel free to interact with housemates and friends and feel a little more comfortable doing so. But on the downside, we know that we have, you know, a much higher risk. And if someone in the house gets sick, there's a good chance that a lot of us will get sick. So we do wear masks around our house when we're not in our rooms to make sure that, you know, we're all being as safe as we can. So it's definitely a change from last year.
I mean, so are people like prepping meals in the kitchen and then just like taking food back to their rooms to eat, or sort of trying to time it so that you're eating in the kitchen at a time when nobody else is there? How does that work?
Yeah, I mean, everybody basically, you know, if we're cooking food, we go to the kitchen, we cook food, finish it up, clean up, and then, you know, bring it back to our rooms and eat. It's definitely been a, you know, a bit of a pretty substantial change from what we're, you know, used to. You know, the sort of the community has changed a lot, I guess, is how I would sum it up.
How's socializing going? Would you say things are back to normal, or are people still keeping a distance?
For us, we're definitely still, for the most part, keeping a distance. Personally, like, I stay in my room most of the time, and I'm very cautious about who I'm hanging out with. You know, I pretty much only hang out with people that I live with, and even then it's with, you know, a little bit of caution, always kind of wondering, you know, and making sure that, you know, nobody that I'm hanging out with has been going to parties or anything like that.
I'm not asking you to call out anyone, but just, are you aware of, like, maybe people in your social media circles or something getting together in larger groups?
Yeah, that, you know, always exists. I think it's kind of inevitable if you bring, you know, a large group of young students. I mean, you have to remember a lot of our, you know, fellow classmates on campus are only 18 years old. You know, they're all still kids. So, you know, it's kind of to be expected that they're going to gather and hang out to some extent. So, yeah, you know, we do see it on social media and, you know, sometimes walking around campus, you know, if you're going for a walk, you can see gatherings or parties of people, but we try and steer clear of that.
Well, like, how do people talk about things like that? Do they say, you know, I know we're not supposed to do this, but it's just a few people and I know everybody who's coming really well, so, you know, come on over and make your own decision? Or is the public health risk even something that gets any attention?
Honestly, most of my friends are pretty safe and aren't hanging out with large groups of people. So within that group, like, our sort of impression of these people who are having, you know, big parties and going to social gatherings is just like, I think it's a little bit of just sort of disbelief and like not really understanding why somebody would want to go and hang out with a big group of people. Like, I know personally myself, I would be freaked out at this point to go to a big party with a bunch of people. But, you know, I can't really speak to what people who are in the, you know, in the boat of wanting to go to parties right now. Like, I can't really speak to what their justification is.
So, like I said, you guys live in at a fraternity. You must have some parties going on in the neighborhood, I'm sure.
Yes, our neighbors are another fraternity, and our neighbors do like to party occasionally.
Oh, dear. Do you know if anybody has confronted them about this?
I don't.
I really don't know either. It always shocks me to see, you know, images posted on social media of, you know, a big party that they've clearly had, you know, at their house inside, and they're all comfortable posting about it. It always just is so jarring. It feels so shocking, given, you know, what it feels like most of the student body exhibits, you know, just generally feeling cooped up and feeling inside, you know, and all of us are definitely a little downtrodden about the whole situation. And it's just a huge juxtaposition to see people posting about their parties online.
It kind of sounds like people on, you know, maybe on campus, like with all the rest of Michigan, it kind of sounds like people are living in two different worlds about this.
Yeah, I would agree in a lot of ways. It is a very strange situation that kind of does force you to, like, decide what world you're going to live in, I guess.
Either of you two know anyone who's gotten sick?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so do I.
What was that like?
I didn't know anybody who got, like, seriously sick. You know, it was mostly just, you know, people who got sick and then, you know, sort of isolated and, I don't know, didn't really talk about it a ton. And then, you know, in a couple of weeks, we're back to normal.
Is there much of a sense of, like, the disease moving through different social circles, like, well, so-and-so had it, and then their roommate got tested, and turns out they were positive too. Do you think people are very aware of the spread, I guess?
I would say people are very aware of the spread, but I think at the end of the day, people have housemates, they live together in groups, and it seems like that is primarily where the spread is happening. You know, it takes one housemate to get sick and the rest of them do. So that seems to be the greatest pattern I've seen. You know, I've got some old roommates from years prior that I know a few of them have gotten sick. And yeah, it's just, it's unfortunate. But, you know, luckily now we have the capacity to get testing every single week if you want to. So a lot of our housemates have opted to do that, which is good because now we can, you know, monitor the situation regularly and hopefully at least prevent that spreading within our own house.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about college life during the pandemic with Amanda Vogel and Theo Zangolis. They're both students at the University of Michigan. Did either one of you ever consider taking a year off and, you know, just skipping it and not doing the online classes, maybe figuring out something else to do with 2020, 2021?
Yeah, I definitely did. I definitely considered it. And I think ultimately the thing that made me decide to continue with classes was just like the realization of like, I didn't know what else I would do. And sort of just, yeah, the feeling of not knowing what else I would do if I didn't go to school. And also just the feeling of like, sort of at this point, like for me, I'm a senior. I just wanted to finish and be done with undergrad.
How about you, Amanda?
Yeah, I would share pretty similar sentiments. You know, starting a PhD program in a pandemic is a big choice. And I really thought about putting it off a year. You know, I had serious conversations with my parents about it. And similarly, you know, I just really wasn't sure what I would do with that gap year. I mean, I don't feel like I did a whole lot last summer when, you know, everything happened. And I think that really fueled my decision to, you know, come back to school. And it's definitely hard. You know, there are a lot of difficulties. You know, I haven't had a chance to meet most of my classmates. And, you know, we move as a cohort, you know, it's a PharmD program. But through all of it, I am happy with my decision to go back to school. I think, you know, putting it off the year wouldn't have really helped my situation at all. I think, you know, I really made the decision because I'm ready to move forward and start the next chapter of my life. And, you know, seeing that healthcare is so, so important this year, I was ready to get started.
I was going to say, this must be a pretty incredible year to be involved in a pharmacy program or really anything related to medicine.
Yeah, no, it's definitely at the forefront of discussion. It's changed some of our curriculum. We have many lessons about, you know, COVID, and, you know, the university has been considering using a lot of my classmates because, you know, we get certified as immunizers to help distribute COVID vaccines. So we haven't started that program yet, but we've, you know, received lots of outreach about our interest in, you know, volunteering to help vaccinate. So in some ways, it's felt very important, you know, really interesting. But yeah, there's a lot of give and take this year.
Do you think you're going to do it, Amanda?
I would love to help vaccinate. You know, it just kind of depends on when the rollout really, really starts going in pharmacies and, you know, how us students can contribute.
Yeah, I mean, it seems right now like there just aren't even enough doses to fully, I guess, mobilize all the people who might be interested in the program, right?
Yeah, definitely. It seems that that is the case.
So, I mean, have either of you actually laid eyes on your professors or TAs in person this year?
Yeah, I had some more in-person components last semester than I did this semester. We had a lot more essential trainings that needed to happen in person. And some of my courses are offered in a hybrid model, which means if you choose to show up to in-person coursework, you can. But there's still an online option offered, and you can decide on a daily basis whether or not you would like to attend in person. So I've definitely been able to see at least a good percentage of my professors, and they've, you know, tried really hard to offer a mixture of availabilities.
How about you, Theo?
No, I haven't seen any of my professors in person. I don't think any of my classmates either. I am living a pretty much entirely virtual life between school and work and everything else.
It sounds like being a monk.
Yeah, I've been comparing it. I've been comparing it to Groundhog Day. It's like I feel like I live the same day over and over and over again. It's very, very boring.
That is exactly how my husband describes this. You know, college instruction varies so much. There are some classes, especially at the undergrad level, where maybe you don't get much of a connection with the professor or the TA. It can be kind of impersonal. And then there are other courses, especially maybe later in a program, where, you know, you have a real intellectual connection with other students and with the instructor. Do either of you feel like you missed out on anything because of the way things are right now? Theo, I'm especially curious about this for you since it's your senior year.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely feel like I didn't get the experience that I would have liked out of my senior year, you know, both in terms of academics and otherwise. But, you know, honestly, this is, you know, pretty much as good as I can ask for, given the circumstances. You know, it's funny, I'm like, I don't think I ever would have said this before, but I do wish that I could trudge through the snow every morning and, you know, walk to campus and sit in the classroom and, you know, be in that environment and, you know, not have the sort of screen between me and someone else to create, you know, the sort of, you know, intellectual and academic relationships with people. But, you know, I think that ultimately this is as best as I can ask for right now.
Right. Amanda, is there anything that you wish were happening right now that's not in terms of your coursework?
I mean, I missed my graduation, you know, last May, which was unfortunate. And now really it is just unfortunate to not meet most of my classmates. Like I said before, you know, it's a cohort. We're supposed to move together and, you know, making those relationships, those professional relationships for the future is just kind of put on hold. You know, I've been lucky enough to make some new friendships and be able to meet up with some of my classmates, you know, just a small number of them, you know, like less than 10 of them I have been able to meet, you know, outside of a classroom setting at all, you know, so that is really just, I think, the thing I miss the most is being able to make friends with my new classmates and form those professional relationships that, you know, are going to guide me through this career.
Yeah. There is obviously huge variation in how people on campuses have been reacting to the pandemic. I'm guessing you guys have heard that Ann Arbor's public schools have been all virtual up to this point. And one of the reasons behind staying that way is because of the relatively high number of COVID cases in the county. And as we mentioned, a lot of those cases have originated from campus. What do you think when you hear people talking about that?
I think it's all incredibly difficult. I think everybody is in a very difficult situation. But I think at the end of the day, if you bring a bunch of, you know, young kids together who have been living in isolation for almost a year, I think it's inevitable that people are going to need to hang out, you know, and I don't think that it is the fault of the 18-year-old for not wanting to live locked in their room for an entire year. You know, so I think if you bring people back to campus, they're going to meet with each other because otherwise you've created an environment where, you know, thousands of students live a life where they exist in their room and nowhere else. So I think it's very difficult all around.
Theo?
Yeah, I just don't think it's very surprising that, you know, there are cases among students. And I think that anybody who acts surprised at that is either very naive or they're lying to you. You know, I can't imagine a situation in which I would realistically expect, you know, thousands of, you know, 18 to 20 year olds to be in a concentrated area and not have at least some of them hang out and, yeah, inevitably spread, you know, the virus.
And yet you still came back.
Yes, yeah, for whatever reason. I'm just holding out hope for when I get the vaccine. That's my light at the end of the tunnel, I guess.
Theo Zangolis is a senior studying political science at the University of Michigan, and Amanda Vogel is a grad student at the College of Pharmacy. Amanda, Theo, it's great to hear your voices, and good luck with the rest of the year.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, April.
And that's Stateside for today. The show is produced by Aaron Allen, Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and by our director, Mercedes Mejia, with additional help from Catherine Nguyen, Nell Ovitt, and Olive Scott. Our executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. I'm April Baer. Thanks so much for tuning in. We'll see you next time.